Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 305 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your host once again. And today, my guest is Kirk Simoneau. Kirk is an attorney up in New Hampshire. And it's a fascinating story of how he went from law school to a fairly sizable firm, you know, large in New Hampshire standards, but maybe mid-sized by other people's standards. No matter what the label is, and immediately, you know, within a very short period of time, became the managing partner at a very young age for a venerable firm that had been around for a long time. And it's a, you know, really interesting story that then segues to the creation of his own solo practice, Red Sneaker Law. And there's, you know, some really interesting stories about how Red Sneaker Law came to be about and how he has positioned himself and branded himself in a very unique way. So I'm very happy to have this conversation with Kirk Simoneau, and I hope you enjoy it. Kirk Simoneau, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you so much, Neil. So happy to be here. Been listening for, we try to figure this out as long as either of us can remember.
Yeah, well, these days, that's like last week for me. I don't know about you.
I keep detailed notes.
I'm not able to remember what I was doing last week these days. But anyway, Kirk, tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Sure. I'm actually a solo practitioner up in New Hampshire. And when I say solo, I mean 100% by myself, no secretary, no paralegal, no nothing, after having run one of the biggest, most successful personal injury firms up here. I run a little practice called Red Sneaker Law. And, you know, it actually isn't billed as a personal injury firm. I promote myself as a personal tragedy firm because I do a little bit of personal injury, a little bit of employment, a little bit of discrimination work. And what I like to do when I describe to people is if you turn to your spouse, if you turn to your significant other and you say, oh my God, honey, I think we need to call a lawyer, then I'm your guy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting perspective on how to niche your practice down. So you said you came from a large personal injury firm. I mean, that's, you know, that's a different kind of beast than a solo practice. No intermediary step. You just went straight from, you know, the big boy shop to running your own firm, huh?
Yeah, I graduated law school and then I joined the personal injury firm, which, you know, up here, you know, a big personal injury firm is, you know, 25, 30 people total, maybe, you know, five lawyers, maybe seven lawyers, something like that.
Yeah, still good size. I mean, I refer to that as your medium size to large, but I know some people would think otherwise, but it's, you got all the challenges. When you say big, certain set of challenges come with that, you know, description. And when you get five attorneys, 25 total people, you got all those challenges. So you got the big boy challenges, as I like to say.
Oh, yeah. If you're hurting one cat, you're hurting five cats. If you're hurting five cats, you're hurting 10 cats. Yeah, it's exactly like that.
100%.
No, but no, I went from that firm where after a year, and I kid you not, no, most people don't believe me, I went from being an associate to the managing partner in 1 year and 2 weeks from when I graduated law school. And I managed people of three of the lawyers who worked for me were former bar presidents of our bar association. We're talking million-dollar advocates, all that kind of stuff. And as time went by and folks got older, we could grow, we could die, we could do a whole lot of different things. COVID hit. And I really just thought, you know what? Now's a really good time to transition to something where I have more control over my schedule, more control over who I represent, and more control over my life. Let me see if I can do this 100% on my own. And so I just did that.
Well, you weren't dissatisfied with your firm, were you?
No, I would absolutely not. I have lunch almost weekly with at least one of my former partners. No, I wasn't dissatisfied, except that, you know, managing a firm with a lot of employees takes a lot of non-legal work. You're doing a lot of selling the art, not making the art.
It's more cat herding, as you said.
Yeah. And early on, one of the things I had to do was let some people go. And I just didn't like having to do that. No. I also didn't like when you have a bigger firm, you have a bigger nut, you have a bigger overhead, and you've got to balance out what the attorneys bring in and what they get paid out. And in order to make that work, you've got to generate a ton of potential clients. You've got to bring in a ton of clients, and you've got to represent a lot of people in cases that maybe you don't really want to be involved in. And I really didn't like that because I became a lawyer for like super specific reasons. And it wasn't so that I could make, you know, a gazillion dollars by representing every Tom, Dick, and Harry who got rear-ended or said they did.
Yep. Well, as a former PI attorney, I can sympathize with that, you know, that position a lot. You know, it's great for those people who really love it. At the end of the day, I didn't really love it. And I didn't hate it, but I just didn't really love it. And as you said, sometimes you want a little more control over what cases you take in. Now, you must have been a pretty good cat herder to go from zero to managing partner in a year. I mean, what was your superpower during that time frame?
All right. So not unlike you, I entered law as a not first career. So I was a tiny bit older than your average.
I was way older, but go ahead.
I try to phrase these things so when I look in the mirror and I see my gray beard, it looks slightly less gray. When I graduated law school, I was actually top of my class and I interviewed at all these great big...
I don't mean to keep interrupting you, but that's where we are different. I might have been old and I certainly wasn't on top of my class, but go ahead.
Well, see, but to me, law school was one of these anomaly type situations in life, right? Somebody hands you at the beginning of the semester, the year, a list of what's going to be needed to be done, when it's going to be needed to be done, and where the information you need to get it done is located. And I had blown off college so much that when I got this list and I actually paid attention to it, I was like, oh my God, this is the easiest thing in the world. So I was able to really, you know, jump up, you know, the line there as far as my performance in law school. But when it came time to start looking for a job, you know, when you're top of the class, you start looking for the gold ring, you start looking at the big firms, you start interviewing at all these different places. And that's a good story that maybe we'll talk about in a minute. But when I went over and interviewed with the guys I ended up with, it was clear. These guys were some of the best lawyers in the state of New Hampshire. And I'm not kidding. We're talking about my mentor, the founding partner of my firm, a gentleman who's since passed named Dave Nixon, got the first $1 million verdict in the state of New Hampshire back in the 1950s. Okay, these were real deal, try a case lawyers, and they didn't know the first thing, not negative first thing about how to run a business, right? You know, they didn't understand how to balance the books. They didn't understand you need to measure the return on investment. They didn't understand any of that stuff. And because I'd had a background running some family businesses, I understood that, right? So while I was there during the first year, I very slowly made sure I started getting more and more access to information. And with that information, I started helping out with making some decisions kind of on the slide so that it wouldn't be super obvious that I was trying to intrude. And over time, they realized maybe the kid can help us, which is kind of how they referred to us. But the first thing I did that was super helpful was every week, Dave Nixon, and so picture a 70 something year old legend. Okay. Guy was president of the state Senate. If a senator or a governor or a congressman needed something, they'd call him on the phone and he'd make them wait on hold for 10 or 15 minutes just because he could. You know, one of these type of power brokers in a small state. And he would every week he would write a newspaper column in our statewide newspaper, and it was an advertisement basically for the firm. And every week during these meetings the partners would have, he would say to the partners, can someone come up with an idea? Can somebody help me? Can someone, you know, write something this week? And everyone would kind of, oh, I'm too busy with this. I've got that trial. I've got this thing going on. So after a while, I listened and watched and read, and I wrote some stuff. And I would go into his office and I would say, here, this is for this week's ad. And here, this is for this week's column. And here's, and all of a sudden, after a couple of months of doing that, Dave stopped asking the rest of the partners to provide anything, because all of a sudden, Dave and I did all the ads, you know. And once you become somebody who is, and this is super important, I think, for your listeners who are thinking about, you know, their careers and what the trajectory looks like and who they want to promote and stuff. If somebody makes themselves invaluable to you in a way that you didn't even ask for, wow, that's going to get some notice. That's going to get some attention. That's going to be super helpful. And you know, so that was one of the ways I started getting access to the books and other stuff, that I was able to point out holes and move my way up.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of law firms like the one that you joined that are, they're profitable, they are prestigious, they have all the trappings of great law firm, and they really don't understand how they got there or why they're there. It's just they got more money left over at the end of the month than it costs them to run the business. And they're not real sure about why that is or how to maximize that. So in that kind of environment, somebody like you who comes from a business background can probably really open their eyes to the potential for doing bigger and better things.
Well, exactly. Like, especially when you ask a question at a personal injury firm, right? Well, what's our average case worth, or how long does it take?
Really hard question for them to answer.
Right. Except if you step into a firm that's got 50 years of existence, right? There's data there. It's just super raw. So it takes a lot of work to go through the data, you know. But you're, one thing that you say that makes so much sense, because I was actually having a conversation with my 16-year-old daughter about something like this the other day. The more money your firm makes, right? Or in her case, she's talking about running a horse business. The more money your horse business makes, the easier it is to cover up the mistakes of your business.
Yeah.
Because it looks like you're doing great. Yeah. And I stepped in and I was able to, admittedly, I wouldn't have been able to step in. I wouldn't have been able to do what I was able to do without these great mentors and guides and teachers and the senior lawyers in the firm who are able to make sure on the legal side of things, I knew what I was doing, because the reality of the law and the books of the law are two totally different things, especially if you have a trial practice.
Today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur is brought to you in part by my friend, Coach Mark Rockwell. Now, that name sounds familiar. You might remember hearing him as our guest on episode 277 of The Law Entrepreneur. And during that episode, we talked about a lot of different things. And one of is the fact that, did you know that only 12% of the law schools provide instruction on how to operate a law firm? 12%. That's one of the reasons managing a firm is difficult for most attorneys, particularly if they have no prior business education or experience. Wouldn't it be great if someone could guide you and save you the time and money figuring out how to grow and manage a profitable firm? Well, I highly recommend you visit with my friend, Coach Mark Rockwell. Mark helps individual attorneys, as well as law firm leadership teams, implement the structure and processes they need to grow and operate profitably. As a lawyer and a businessman, Mark knows firsthand what it's like to face the challenges of growing a profitable firm. Mark can help you do the same. Go to his website, coachrockwell.com, and download the Law Firm Checkup. That's Law Firm Checkup, which Mark will review with you at no cost. You'll get great insights on how to build a healthy, thriving law firm. You can call Mark directly at 503-784-7205 or visit his website at coachrockwell.com. That's coachrockwell.com. And my thanks to him personally for sponsoring today's episode. If you've been a listener of this podcast for any time, you know that I sing the praises of Ruby all the time because they're really responsible in my own practice for helping me grow my business, deliver personalized experience to my clients, you know, building customer loyalty, really, in terms of having a consistent front-facing office partner in Ruby, and allows me to stay connected anywhere, anytime to my business through their services. So I can't say enough about Ruby. I'm delighted to have them and continue to have them as a sponsor of this podcast. You know, we build this podcast as attempting to answer the question when they didn't teach us in law school about running a business. But the other thing they didn't teach us in law school very well is about actually being an attorney. You learn how to think like an attorney. You learn how to research like an attorney. You learn some of the, you know, the background of the laws that you're hoping to uphold and adhere to. But, you know, unless you really spent an awful lot of time in your trial skills class or worked at, you know, at the law school itself in some of the ventures where they're providing services to the community, you really didn't actually know how to put on a case or how to try a case or how to manage a client. And while that isn't exactly the business of the law, it is the operations of the legal practice. And that's another area where I think law schools don't do a good enough job.
Oh, I 100% agree. So one of the reasons, I went to what is now called the University of New Hampshire School of Law, and I was in a program called the Daniel Webster Scholar Program. It's the only program of its kind in the country. It is a 2-year-long honors program where when you graduate, you do not have to take the traditional bar exam. You're a lawyer. So I was actually a lawyer the day before I graduated law school. But for 2 years, I'm doing simulations. I'm doing mock trials. I'm doing all sorts of things like that. My work is being reviewed by the justices of the New Hampshire Supreme Court. I have a dedicated bar examiner. It's a tremendous opportunity. But more than that, like I became a lawyer, and I'm going to segue into the I became a lawyer because story, and I'm going to warn you and your viewers in advance, not a happy story. Yeah. This is now almost 20 years ago, my wife and I got tickets for Christmas to visit my parents who were snowbirds down in Florida. And we flew down to Florida, and it's important to know my mom and dad are deaf. So sign language, can't hear anything, can't call on the phone. All that kind of stuff, deaf. It's important to remember it's 20 years ago. There's no texting, right. You know, all that kind of stuff. And our flight arrives.
There's no cell phones. And
yeah, the iPhone didn't become thing until 2007, yep. Right? So we hop in the rental car, and I had rented a beautiful convertible because, you know, we're two young people. It's Florida. We've got our little baby. So that's the most practical thing you can possibly do. And to make a very long story short, it's 8 o'clock at night. My dad is kind of waiting under this tree for us because he's waving at every car that goes by for about an hour, according to my mom. And we make the turn around the corner. My dad jogs up to the side of the car and tells us what parking space at their condo to park at because we'd never been down there before because I refuse to visit because I hate staying with people because there's a reason Conrad Hilton is rich, right? Mm-hmm. So we park the car. I turn and reach to shake my dad's hand as he's standing there reaching to shake my hand. And a little convertible Miata came along, the kind with the headlights that used to flip up, but the headlights weren't up. And the driver hit my dad, carried him down the road about 60 yards. And then drunk driver, all that kind of stuff. And it was horrible, right? It was absolutely horrible for all the reasons everybody listening thinks it was horrible.
Yeah.
But then after it stops being horrible in that way, imagine getting a letter from the prosecutor's office sent to your 60-year-old deaf mother, who, because she's 60 years old and deaf, reads at a third grade level, and she can't understand a damn thing in the letter. Imagine that same prosecutor's office calling your mother on the telephone, even though she can't talk on the telephone, even though there's no video phones, even though there's no none of that stuff, and trying to make an appointment so they can talk about the case with her. And so we went through a lot of that kind of stuff. And I said to my wife at that point, I said, gee, you know what? I bet you I could do this a whole hell of a lot better than the way these people are doing this. And I meant the prosecutors, I meant the civil lawyers we hired and everybody, you know, in that
involved.
My thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because my family wasn't the number five on the McDonald's menu, right? We were a little bit different because of the disability that was involved. So I decided to go to law school, and that's how I ended up going to law school. And right now, I would say about a third, if not 40% of my client base are deaf or otherwise disabled individuals in cases having absolutely nothing to do with their disability, right? Deaf people get rear-ended just as often as anybody else, right?
Percentage-wise, sure.
Yeah. So yeah, and I forget why we started down that road, but I became aware.
The point of this is, and I wanted to circle back to it because I think it bears bringing out, is that you were in a unique program in law school that, frankly, kind of mimics the way law was taught back in the day. You read for the bar. You interned with an established attorney, and you learned all the trappings of how to be a lawyer, without the benefit of sitting in a large classroom being lectured to by a law professor. And I think we've lost that. And a little bit of that was recreated in the program that you were in. And when you couple that with your personal motivation as to why you wanted to become a lawyer, I think it creates a powerful mechanism for creating excellence. And clearly, clearly you're an example of that.
Well, I appreciate that. And you're right. I think it is something that, like, I had a conversation earlier today, right, with a young lawyer who I inherited a case from for a host of different reasons. So I called her up to chat about the case and say, why don't we have lunch next week so we can chat about it? And she literally said to me on the call, oh, well, why didn't you just shoot me an email or schedule it with my assistant or something like that? And I said to her, I said, well, because I can't hear the tone in your voice when I ask you about the case right off the bat. And I wouldn't know then if it's really as bad as I think it is. And she laughed a little bit and didn't realize that I was dead serious. And that's one of the things that you learn, though, right? As you get older, as opposed to being younger, you get experience, you understand how to read different tones and things like that. But I think that in law school today, yeah, if you're sitting in a classroom of 200 people and it's the Socratic method and all that kind of stuff, and you get called on once a semester and you haven't had to stand up and make a point or an argument or defend one, then you're missing a lot. Because one of the things we forget is people in the real world, like regular folks, they hate us. People do not like lawyers. Look at every study, look at every survey that ever asks about it. They hate the living hell out of us. So when you have, I've had trials, and I kid you not, where I've started my closing argument by apologizing to the jury for the defense lawyer behaving exactly like they thought a defense lawyer would behave like. I don't talk like a lawyer. I don't look like a lawyer. I wear red sneakers to court, because people don't like lawyers. So don't give them that. Don't give them something they don't like, and they won't see you and immediately dislike you. Maybe they'll give you the time of day and listen to what you have to say.
Well, it's an interesting positioning and branding concept here. Before we get to that, I want to just mention, I think I've said this before, but at the CRISP Game Changers Summit, Mike Mogul, CRISP runs down in Atlanta, which, by the way, this year will be in November, 2nd and 3rd, I believe. And I always enjoy going to that summit. But a couple of years ago, he, to your point, had a slide up. And I forget the source of the information on the slide, but it ranked professions and what the public thought of them, and, you know, in terms of respect. And lawyers were ranked lower than prostitutes.
Right, because
which I thought was just stunningly appropriate and made me laugh. And I've never, tell that story.
Well, unless you're on a ice shanty in Ohio ice fishing, which is a big news story these days. Yeah. If you're being super honest about what you do, right?
Right.
People don't like lawyers because we say things we don't believe in for money, and I don't do that, and I've never done that, right?
So
I don't
talk about how you have branded yourself, Red Sneaker Law.
Yeah,
you wear the sneakers to court. You have a very minimalistic website. You have a very different approach to branding a solo practice and positioning a solo practice than, frankly, most other folks do. And in that in itself is, you know, niching down right there. But give me a little bit of the thinking behind what went into Red Sneaker Law.
Sure. And another happy story. So about 12 years ago, so a year or so after I became a lawyer, I was diagnosed with a very painful, unfortunate neurological disorder that mostly affects the left side of my body. And I'm in physical pain 24/7. And I stopped being able to wear grown-up shoes. I had, and my wife could tell you, I had a collection of, I don't even know how many, unbelievably awesome, expensive, fancy lawyer shoes. And I stopped being able to wear them. It physically caused me pain. And if anyone touched me, bumped me, anything like that, it would also cause me pain. So I was at a hearing or a trial, and I honestly can't remember which. But anyway, opposing counsel one day accidentally bumped into my foot. And I spent about 45 minutes in the men's room, just in tears. I was in agony. It hurt so much. And we resumed whatever the heck we were doing. And that night I'm at home and I'm at dinner. And I'm talking to my wife and three daughters about this. And my oldest daughter, who was about 9 at the time, said something to the effect of, you know, Daddy, if you wore bright red sneakers, people would notice and no one would ever bump into you. Because at that point I was wearing black nondescript sneakers, kind of like David Boyd does. And I went, that's a heck of an idea, honey. And we went out literally that night, drove down to the Nike outlet, bought a bright red pair of sneakers. And I wore them to whatever the thing was. It must have been a court hearing the next day. And I've been wearing them ever since. There was a point where I was at a conference and I had the red sneakers. And I was at that point, I was on a cane. I needed a cane. And so I have a cane. I got the red sneakers and everything else is dressed exactly like what you envision a lawyer being dressed like, except, you know, taller and better looking. And and Howard Nations walks by me and says to me, damn, I wish I had thought of that gimmick 40 years ago. And I went, oh, wait a minute here. It's not a gimmick. It's actually legitimate and real. But as I went along here in New Hampshire, I would try cases and I sort of became the guy who tried cases wearing the red sneakers. And then I got a couple of decent verdicts and I became the guy who got a couple of decent verdicts wearing the red sneakers.
Who won cases wearing the red sneakers.
And then they started using my cases to teach our new lawyers through our trial academy, through our Association of Justice, using my trial. And then I got to go teach that. And I'm the guy wearing the red sneakers. And I got to go speak to these people wearing the red. And all of a sudden I become the red sneaker lawyer guy. And so when it became time to go out on my own, I was thinking to myself, what do I call the firm? What do I call the firm? What do I call the firm? And I'm like, you know what? I'm just the red sneaker lawyer. It's the idea to me in life always has been to take some negative, take some tragedy, take some horrible obstacle in life, right? And see if I can't turn it into some kind of opportunity. And that's what I did here. And it's not a marketing thing in any sense of the imagination because it's legit, except it's also a marketing thing in every sense of the imagination.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, it may be, maybe I'm just being too practical about this. There may be something geographically oriented around this too, that this really resonates in New Hampshire, might not resonate, say, in other parts of the country. I don't know.
You know what it is? It's the story, right? So I actually have clients as far away as Arizona who have heard the story through one avenue or another. But the thing is this, and the minimal website and that kind of thing, is I only work for people or with people who have been referred to me by somebody I've worked with before that I like, or by another lawyer that I like. So I've decided that my marketing positioning is one of scarcity, right? If you sort of like the A-team, if you can find them and your cause is just maybe you can hire the A-team. And I've created that kind of dynamic for myself. And because I've had successful results, it has worked for me. And I mean, obviously, it can't work for everybody, except I will use two examples from the non-legal world. There's a venture capital firm, and I wish I could remember the name of it as we sit here, but I can't. I'm sure it'll come to me as soon as we hang up, who is one of the most successful venture capital firms in history. And their website is literally a phone number because they don't need, you know, 9 gazillion solicitations. If they see an opportunity, you know, they'll pursue it. And then there's Bill Murray, the actor. Bill Murray doesn't have an agent. Bill Murray has an 800 number. If you want to make a movie and you want to work with Bill Murray, you leave a message on the 800 number and maybe Bill Murray calls you back if he likes the message. Mm-hmm. And I took those kind of things and I thought, okay, if I really do think I'm better at this than most people are better at this, can I create an environment where I get to pick and choose and, you know, do that? And so far since, you know, however long it's been now, it's been almost 2 years or 2 years or so, it's worked out for me so far really, really well.
Well, I think it's great. And it is certainly unique. It takes a lot off your plate. You don't have to worry about you're creating this brand without actually going to a lot of effort to really brand your law firm. So kudos to you in that regard. So let's talk then about how you're making it work. Because as a true solo, or as I like to say, a three-man firm consisting of me, myself, and I, you got a lot to do. Even if you're not spending a lot of time, you know, building a brand, you know, other than what you're going through in terms of word of mouth and top of mind. So what are some of the things that make you successful as a solo? Are you leveraging technology? Are you maximizing your cost per case? What makes your practice successful?
Well, so let's back up though to the idea of you know, minimalizing the idea of branding. Branding a brand as sort of best of class is a lot more work than it looks like, right? Creating this, a website with a phone number. So for example,
I don't mean to diminish that. Let me just apologize.
Oh, no. I just want to make sure it's clear for anyone listening if they want to sort of stake out that territory.
Just fall off the log and have a great reputation.
No, you've got to try cases. And more importantly, I think you've got to be out and in front of people, right? You've got to be able to stand in front of an audience, whether you're doing a CLE or you're giving a presentation to some other group. And you've got to be able to be a subject matter expert. So most people in this state will turn to me for if there's anything involving anybody with a disability, but it's a trial. So I'm not talking about getting your disability certified through the government or any of that kind of stuff. How do I interview this blind client? How do I do this? How do I do that? And so I'll do a lot of CLEs on things like that. And I'll also do a lot of CLEs on how to try a case here. And you've got to be able to show that you've got that ability. And that takes a tremendous, I think, amount of effort, A, to get those opportunities. Yeah. And B, to then
to
show
deliver
up.
On.
Yeah. And to show up and actually be what they expect you to be, because when you're the red sneaker guy, muted red sneakers. I've had a judge within the last 3 months start a hearing by criticizing the fact that my sneakers were maroon. Yeah. So, but again, that's branding, right? That's part of, you know, but it's also true to me. But getting back to how do I make it work? You know, what do I do? So I think the number one key to what makes my practice work is the way I schedule my day. I'm super, super regimented about what I do, when I do it, how I batch activities and things like that. So for example, I schedule phone calls and things like that at either 11:30 in the morning or about 4:15 in the afternoon, because people are waiting to get to lunch or they're waiting to end their day. So whatever that is that needs to be talked about, they're going to hurry up and get it done, which allows me to be that much more efficient because I'm doing that at that time of day, but I'm not going to pick up my phone in the middle of the day or whatever. I'm going to only do it during these periods of time. I do the same thing with when I work on cases. What type of work I do on the cases is segmented by time of day when I'm more productive on certain types of things. That to me has always been sort of the key to being successful, is figuring out what your ebb and flow is and making that work to the best of your ability. I don't have enough cases for technology to be a significant factor for me. I don't have enough incoming or outgoing communication for technology to be a big enough factor for me. Although back when I ran the firm, we used all the different practice management stuff. And I tried to do it here on my own, but the amount of time it took to do the data input was I'd settle the case before I finished putting all the information into the system.
So productivity seems to be the secret sauce.
Absolutely.
And as manifested by your calendar.
And calendar is the key word, right? So everything gets calendared. So for example, if I'm going to work on the Smith motion to dismiss, I know it's due whenever it's due. My calendar is going to be blocked off for those 2 hours on whatever morning it's going to be worked on. And it's there and it's plain as day. And everything else is calendared out as well. And I'll have a random list of tasks that if I need to get something, you know, a few things done and I have a transition period or something takes less time than I thought or something, I can turn to that list and work on that list. But everything that I do in a given day, I'm talking about from my workout to a half an hour reading in the evening to whatever it is, it's calendared. I get an alert that tells me, okay, Kirk, stop doing this, start doing that. And it is, if the weeks or days that I actually follow that are amazing as far as how much I can get done, as opposed to, you know, when you keep your Outlook open and you respond. I always amaze when people respond to emails right away. It always blows my mind. I just keep thinking, don't you have something else you should be working on right now? That
I wasn't expecting
forward?
A response right away. Yeah. Well, yeah, you actually surprised me because I was about ready to say you sound a bit like an analog. You use a day runner, but you gave it away when you said Outlook and notification. So,
oh no, I actually use the Full Focus Planner system, which is by a guy named Michael Hyatt.
Yep.
And so I use that, but you know, I also supplement it with my calendar and with reminders, because as soon as I hit 50, I stopped remembering like today's Tuesday, right? I think, you know, I mean, it really became like that. And but I use both because the analog really helps. And also what I like about that particular system is it really gets you to prioritize. Okay, here are the three things this week that are really going to move my goals forward. And then you break that down by day. Yeah. And I think a lot of young lawyers and a lot of just solo practitioners are really busy chasing. They're busy chasing. And I don't, you don't, if you want to be successful, you don't chase, maybe you hunt, you know, you know what game you're going after and you hunt that game down, as opposed to you just, you know, oh, something blew in the wind over there on the left. Let me run that way. Something blew in the wind over on the right. Let me run that way. That's not going to get you where you need to be. But I do have a system whereby I have a set number of cases So for instance, I have a cap on the number of cases I accept, and I'm at that cap now, for example. So I talked to somebody yesterday who had sounded like a great case. I say, sorry, I can't help you, because it would be a disservice both to me and you and the other folks. But every single case I have, I look at least once every 7 days. And having a system like that, where you can make sure everything's moving forward and figure out what needs to move forward next is super helpful. And using a combination of the digital and the analog, I think is the best way to do that.
I want to make sure, I think I might have talked over you, that make sure our listeners heard that you were championing the planner by
Michael Hyatt.
Right. Yeah, the Full Focus Planner. So you can get that. Michael, I've been lucky enough to meet him a couple of times. I have, looking over the bookshelf here,
rebranded today to it's no longer Michael Hyatt and Company. It's Full Focus is the name of the.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the planner's obviously doing pretty well. He's rebranding his entire company. So great guy. I loved his books. Book Yourself Solid was the first one I think I read. And the planner is, you know, people who love planners swear by it. So I have no affiliation with it. So if you want to check that out, please do so. Actually, just a couple short wrap-up here questions here, Kirk. Are you a journaler?
No, because I'm a writer. So I've taken So for instance, the story about my dad, the story about my leg, all those kinds of things. And I've been working on both a sort of a newsletter that I'm trying to turn into a book that talks about, well, gee, when these horrible, horrible things happen to you, how is it that you survive and turn them into something more than just being a victim? Yeah. So I put most of my writing energy into that, which is, I suppose, a form of a journal. But no, I'm not a big journaler.
Okay. Yeah. And you're seeking outlets for those stories?
Yeah. So right now I'm working on developing a newsletter and a book and, you know, in a Substack. I'm looking into Substack, which is a subscription newsletter service. But right now it's all just sort of in the exploratory stage.
Right. Well, listen, Kirk, I mean, this is fascinating. I find it really interesting how you've been able to, you know, deal with the stuff you've had to deal with and turn it into a positive action that moves your life forward and those of your clients in better ways. You're not exactly a conformist and you have your own uniqueness that I think is really refreshing. And there's a lot to be learned from your story. And I appreciate you sharing it with us today. So tell our audience, what's the best way to reach out to you if they want to follow up and just applaud you or otherwise get in touch with you?
Yeah, if you go to redsneakerlaw.com, you'll find three things: my email, my phone number, and an opportunity to sign up for the newsletter that I just mentioned. But I actually want to take this opportunity, Neil, to tell you, I talk to so many young lawyers, part of our mentor program and with some of the work I do at the law school. And I tell all of them that they really do need to think of themselves as entrepreneurs. And I tell them that they should download and listen to your podcast because I'm not trying to be flattering or ingratiating. I'm really just telling you straight up the truth is so much that we take for granted having had lives before being lawyers are absent in the K through JD universe. And I think, you know, I ran a business thing and now I'm trying to do it as an artist to see if that works differently. And I keep falling back on everything I know about how to run a business. So even though it seems unique and it seems nonconformist and it seems all those kinds of things, I got a written plan somewhere, right? So the service that you give, especially newer lawyers who are forced to hang out their shingles, which is a third of the lawyers here in this state, is tremendous. I think you should be applauded, which I'm not going to do now because I think it'll sound horrible in this empty room.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. I do appreciate it. And you know, I keep coming to grips with the fact that there must be some truth to that because, hell, we're still at it, 300 and some odd episodes into this journey. And I just about on a weekly basis get, you know, confirmation of that from one person or another. And I do appreciate you taking the time to share that with our audience. And most importantly, I thank you for taking the time to be with us today on The Law Entrepreneur. And I look forward to chatting with you again sometime in the near future.
All right, great. Hey, take care, Neil.
Thanks so very much, Kirk. Appreciate it.
Bye now.
Well, how about that? That's a wrap for this episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I'd like to thank our sponsors once again, as usual, Daylight by Market Circle, Spotlight Branding, Ruby, as in Ruby Receptionists, and our newest sponsor, Security Plus. If you have a chance, swing on by our website at www.lawentrepreneur.com. You can check out a bunch of information and resources there. And if that doesn't satisfy your needs, swing on by our Facebook page or Twitter page. You can find those just by simply searching for The Law Entrepreneur. And if you'd be so kind, I would greatly appreciate it if you go to your podcast application and leave us a rating and an honest review. If you find this podcast is helpful and that you're getting value out of it, it does help with our visibility and ensures that we're going to be there for another 5 years or so, as this has been quite the run. And I'm greatly appreciative of your interest in The Law Entrepreneur.